You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
She's my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud. What's in the box?
And like that, he's gone.
Hello, and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and today we will be spoiling A Wrinkle in Time, Ava DuVernay's new adaptation of the beloved Madeleine L'Engle novel. Here to talk with me about the movie are Slate culture writer and the host of the Represent podcast, Aisha Harris.
Hello, Dana.
Hi, Aisha. Thanks for coming in. And our culture editor, Forrest Wickman. Hey, Forrest.
Hey, Dana.
So I believe we all saw A Wrinkle in Time at the same screening, although I didn't see you guys there a couple nights ago, right?
I think so. I saw a few of us scattered about, including like Julia and the Culture Fest crew.
Yeah, I think every Slatester who could get in there wanted to go because this was kind of a hot ticket of the year. So before we start spoiling, let me just go around. Aisha, I know what you think because you reviewed the movie, but tell our listeners just a quick thumbnail recap, pro or con.
My thumb is in the middle. I thought there were some really moving moments. I think in the review I mentioned that Ava DuVernay knows how to make your eyes well up, and I definitely actually started crying at one point, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, I want to know what point it was. I only cried once, too.
Yes, but then there were also just, it also just was kind of messy, and really not, I was not the target audience for this movie, and I could not tap into my inner 12-year-old. So
yeah, we need to talk about that. Who is and what kids, if any, would be drawn to this movie too? And Forrest, what about you?
There's a line in this movie where they say aberrations are far more interesting. And I feel like that is one of the nicer things I could say about this movie. I think it's kind of an interesting failure. There's so much good stuff in it, both in terms of its like extremely progressive and in many ways groundbreaking intentions and achievements in terms of representation, and also just like the imagery is frequently stunning. And yet I just felt like it didn't really cohere.
Yeah, I have to say, I think for me, this is the big disappointment of the year so far. It was only early March, so there could be more to come. But I guess because our expectations were high and it's an unusual combination of creator and project, and this book, except for, I think, an animated adaptation decades ago, has never been adapted for the screen. So
there was a TV movie in 2003,
Is that the animated thing I'm thinking
no,
of?
No, this was a live action one. I didn't know about an animated version. But yeah, there was a TV movie that most people have forgotten. I think it was also Disney from 2003, that was deemed to be like not a good adaptation.
And there's speculation that it's kind of an unfilmable book. Having just reread the book, I can kind of see where that comes from, because just before we get into the movie, just a quick note on the book is just that it's extremely conceptual. It's, you know, it really is kind of speculative sci-fi for kids. So it has lots of idea-based scenes in it, you know, things like what would it be like to be two-dimensional on a two-dimensional planet, or how do you explain light to a creature that's never seen light? And those are kind of, for a kid, those are really mind-blowing kind of ideas to explore, but they're obviously hard to get across on screen. And in fact, the way that DuVernay solves most of those problems, and the two screenwriters, Jennifer Lee and Jeff Stockwell, solve that problem, is just to cut those more kind of speculative scenes.
Yeah, some of those scenes are so wild. Like, there's a scene, one of the better scenes in this, I think, is when we learn that there are these flowers that, quote, speak in color. And there are so many really abstract, conceptual, like, whoa, man, how do you explain light to a child, or whatever you just said, scenes, Dana, that I actually Googled to figure out whether this book was written before LSD. And it was.
But it is definitely trippy. And the movie, if nothing else, does try to capture some of that trippiness. I think what it may capture the weirdness of the trippiness, the aberration quality, like you say, but it doesn't necessarily capture the sense of insight, right? That sense of epiphany or insight that you associate with kind of like, you know, stoner conversations. All right, but let's get into our own stoner conversation and just set up how this movie starts, which actually is quite similar to the book, with some important differences. So as we begin, we seem to be in maybe Southern California, right? Or some kind of setting. We're in the present day and we're getting to know the Murray family. So let's set up who they all are.
Well, I guess, I should preface this by saying that I've only read the book once. I think I was in sixth grade, so that would have made it almost 2 decades ago since I've read it. So this is all very new to me. But I do know that in the book, Meg had at least 3 or 4 siblings.
There's a pair of twins that are cut out.
There's a pair of twins. Yeah. That's it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are no twins. It's just Meg. And the movie opens with a very young Meg. So not Storm Reid, who plays the 14, 15-year-old Meg, but a very young Meg in their family's laboratory, sort of. And she's bonding basically with her father, Chris Pine, playing Alex Murray. They bond over the science experiment, and then we also see her mother come in, Kate, who is played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and they have this touching family moment where they give her like the
Yeah,
those
it's
things?
Like a paper fortune teller.
Yeah.
It's like that little claw thing that kids use, and then it's origami, and then they fold it out to tell your fortune.
Right, and guess different things that are written on
right.
each. Right.
And right. then we get this kind of big theme, which is they tell the young Meg that their love is not gone, it's just enfolded.
Because the heart is on the paper thing, and then it disappears.
Right. They're able to sort of make it appear and disappear and appear and disappear. Which, like, why are they supposed to be telling that to Meg? Is it just because, I think I only figured out one plausible explanation later, which is this is around the time that her new little brother is on the way. And so are they just like setting her up for the fact that they will still love her, even though they appear to only love the younger kid?
I wondered about that, too.
It just seems like a really random thing, like, and sort of awful thing. Like, you might think we don't love you anymore, but we're just not showing it outwardly.
Well, then I wondered if it was just that, like, did Alex know maybe that he might be disappearing for a while? And like, that's why he's saying this. I don't know. But they do hint that she's getting or they say, like, your brother's coming soon in that same scene.
Right.
And her brother's adopted, right?
Yeah, they established that as well. Her little brother, Charles Wallace, is adopted.
Who they always refer to as
Charles Wallace.
Which is another one of the sort of weird, I assume that's from the book, right?
Yeah, that's his name in the book. Although in the book, he's sometimes called Charles as well. And in the movie, he's only Charles Wallace
in the movie, which can get like pretty awkward and clunky when you have to start every sentence with like, Charles Wallace, comma.
Charles Wallace, no!
But it goes with the strange formality of his character, which is completely different from in the book. He's not described as being this kind of little preppy who walks around in sweater vests.
He reminded me of what's his name from Modern Family. Sofia Vergara's son in the show, who's very like prim and proper and kind of nerdy, but like smart, like wise beyond his years.
Right.
Manny. That's what he reminds me of.
I assume that the reason that they always refer to him as Charles Wallace is because it sounds like a very adult name and so underlines how precocious he is, but his character I just found kind of baffling in general.
Character. Let's get into Charles Wallace, who's introduced in the very next scene where we cut forward by 3 years.
Right.
Her father
has
disappeared down a wrinkle in time, which we'll get to what that is. And so the family has been left with the single mom raising them. And she goes down to the kitchen late at night because she can't sleep in a storm. The first line of the book is, it was a dark and stormy night, by the way, which is a great, challenging way to begin your novel. Like, I'm going to write a novel with this first sentence and make it really original anyway. So she goes down, meets Charles Wallace, and talk a little bit about Charles Wallace, the super precocious kid. I mean, even on paper, he's a little bit hard to take, but within the kind of conceptual world of the book, and also because of the fact it was written in 1962, when maybe, you know, the idea of precocious childhood had not been as tapped out, he was a little more bearable.
Yeah, I think the cliche problem, which Aisha, you talked a little bit about in your review, just comparing it to sort of other demon child movies and stories, which is something we'll get to later. But I think that the cliche thing is a little bit of a problem. Charles Wallace, like, how old is he supposed to be? I don't know. I mean,
in real life, he's 9.
Okay.
So, yeah, I Googled it. I was like, how old is this kid?
Yeah, I think the actor, whose name is Derek McCabe, was 8 when he played the part. In the book, he's supposed to be 5, which would really be ridiculous. Oof, yeah. He seems more like he's supposed to be about 8.
Right. Well, and the fact that he's adopted and it's been 4 years means that you don't... I don't know if I was... got the adopted detail for sure. So I think
it
I
really
was wondering, like,
by.
Is he supposed to be 4 or 5? Anyway.
And unlike Storm Reid, who I think really does a great job with the character, even when the character is a little bit weakly written or underwritten, she's really excellent. But this other kid, I hate to be mean to a kid actor, but he's grating. He just does not sell.
I'm
that
glad I'm
precocity
not the only
thing.
One.
Well, but
I was like, this, I already don't like child actors generally.
Well, there's a line in your review, Aisha, when you're like, the cast is mostly outstanding. And I was like, I bet she's talking about Charles
well,
Wallace.
I meant Charles
but you don't
Wallace.
Want to come out.
Yeah, I meant Charles Wallace and the Ansel Elgort lookalike, who also is saddled with just really terrible dialogue and is just there to be pretty. But
I loved that character, but we can get to that later. I couldn't figure out whether it was his fault or just the movie's fault. I think the movie is asking a lot of that young actor to play this character who at first, so as we see in that Dark and Stormy Night scene, like she's made, he's made his sister like warm milk, and we are not necessarily entirely sure why, because it's because of the storm, but then we also learn via Michelle Norris on NPR radio, that it's because it's exactly the 4-year anniversary of the father's disappearance. And so he is super supportive. And the next day when Meg gets bullied and the kid is absurdly mean and is like, happy anniversary, I see why your dad left, or something like that, which is an unbelievably mean line, I think.
It's also just not psychologically realistic that kids would tease each other on a playground about your father disappearing into time space or whatever. I mean, you could easily find something else she could be bullied about. Part of the problem, though, is a classic movie problem that's not even this movie. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. But she's too beautiful and too together, right? I mean, Meg Murray is supposed to be a little bit of a mess. At least they could just slap some braces on her or something. I mean, she's just a pretty girl with cute clothes who seems like she would fit in fine, and I don't quite understand why she's this misfit that the movie's purporting that she is.
Well, they seem to imply that, well, the way that playground scene kicks off when she eventually throws the ball straight at the bully's face on the playground is that Charles Wallace overhears two teachers talking about how, like, their family has gotten weird, or they've, like, Meg is now no longer the promising kid she used to be, and he starts yelling at the teachers, and then runs over to her on the playground, and he's like, don't listen to them, like, you have more talent in your pinky than she has in her whole body. And then that, like, kicks off the other girl on the playground saying this is, like, making fun of her. So it was like, it didn't just come out of the blue, but and that leads into the other problem with Charles Wallace is just he's so unbelievable in a way. I don't know any kid, I don't know, he's that kid from all those movies who's just like, too, he knows, he's an adult clearly wrote these lines,
right?
Like,
I think that problem exists a little bit for Meg too, where you know, Charles Wallace early on, as you say, is like telling her how amazing and talented she is. We don't totally see why, I don't think, until all of the sudden towards the end of the movie, she does this absurdly elaborate physics calculation in her head that, like, I don't think any actual, like, I don't think Einstein could do.
While a giant tornado is threatening to whistle away.
And it comes a little bit out of nowhere. I think I did get why she's insecure, though. Like, she wears glass. She's not, like, conventionally by the standards of mainstream 21st century white society conventionally attractive, right? Like, she wears glasses, she dresses like not super femme, and she has curly hair, and we see later in the movie the version of her that either she or the It, which is a dark force we'll get to later, produces as the version of herself that everyone would like, and it's like somebody with straight hair and no glasses and dresses very femme. And so that I kind of got, even though I agree.
I guess, like, I can see that. But the group that rejects her is multiracial, right? I mean, it's not because she's not conforming to the standard of whiteness that she's rejected. Exactly. But there is this ongoing thing about her hair, which I want to get to also because Calvin is strangely fawning over it at several different points during the movie.
Calvin just kind of comes out of nowhere.
So Calvin, we got to establish him. So this is the threesome, the threesome of kids that will go traveling through wrinkles in time. Meg Murray, her little brother, Charles Wallace, the psychic genius who understands and knows all. And Calvin, who is somebody that they meet all of a sudden in the street because he doesn't he just say, I felt a need to come to this place?
Right. Right. And then Charles Wallace is like, I sent you here because you are good at diplomacy. This is such a bizarre movie.
Well, that actually does come straight from the book as well, which is that it's kind of implied that Charles Wallace and Calvin share some kind of mind melding psychic talents that don't really get developed until they start traveling through time and space.
I did not get that at all.
The movie doesn't establish that at all. The movie does a terrible job of establishing Calvin, who I love in the book. He's a great character. But you were saying that you like Calvin in the movie, so talk about
why.
It's precisely the fact that he is so absurdly underdeveloped and is just there to like gaze lovingly with his perfect blonde hair and blue eyes at Meg. And like, there's this quote, I loved this before I read this quote, but I found later Ava DuVernay's thinking for the character, which is that she says she wanted to cast Levi Miller, this young, like very handsome young boy, because that was so powerful to show a white boy following a black girl through the movie. Like, it's just fun. It kind of reminds me of Chris Pine in Wonder Woman, where he's just there to be the male damsel in distress and look pretty. And it's just like a fun trend, I think, in the movies. And it's refreshing, even if his character is completely like bland.
But there's something, again, just psychologically unrealistic about the amount of compliments that people are always showering on Meg. Like, I don't know why she has low self-esteem since everyone in her life seems to be building her up at every single second.
Everyone does. I mean, the other, I can understand, look, if I was, when I was 11, 12, 13, whatever, I totally would have loved seeing this white boy following this black girl. It's, I remember watching Boy Meets World, and when Angela came on the show in like the later seasons and started dating Sean Hunter, I was like, "What? This is amazing!" And it made me happy to see that. But as a function of the actual plot of the story, he has, I think, besides Charles Wallace, I think he has the clunkiest lines.
Do you have any idea how incredible you are, Aisha?
And he literally is just, okay, I'm going to go on this adventure after having met them that day. This all takes place in the span of like a day. It's just weird. I mean, I guess we should probably talk about the witches.
Yeah, so now we have to get them into space. We haven't even gotten them into space yet.
So much plot.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18+. So the way this first gets set up, the first of the three witches, I mean, I think of them as three witches anyway, the three misses, as they call them, that they meet is Mrs. What's It, who is played by Reese Witherspoon, and who appears, I believe, just suddenly, on the dark and stormy night, she just suddenly appears knocking at the door of their house, right?
I think it's later that day. It's the night after, I think. After she's gotten, after Meg has gotten kicked out of, or like scolded for, by the principal, she comes home.
Who's played by Andre Holland, who is a great actor, who
totally underutilized.
Yeah.
But yes, it's later that day, and then she's like arguing with her mom about what happened at school, and she says, you know, Dad would have told me to stick up for myself, and her mom says, well, you can't use your father against me. And then all of a sudden, Reese Witherspoon as Mrs. Watson is downstairs with Charles Wallace.
Here is a place where the kind of realistic world that's set up in the first couple minutes of the movie, and then the completely trippy, magical space traveling world that is going to take up the rest of the movie, kind of grind against each other really awkwardly. Because, of course, what you would really do if Reese Witherspoon with long red braids and wearing a sheet came into your house and just introduced herself and plonked herself down is call the cops.
Yeah.
Try to figure out why you're being kind of home invaded by a weirdo. But they are all really accepting of this whimsical figure who comes in and introduces herself as Mrs. What's-It.
Yeah, there was a real opportunity for sort of classic fish out of water comedy there that they just didn't quite capitalize
They
on.
Miss it even more with Oprah. We'll get there. But there could have been so much good comedy.
There was a little bit in there, I think. But it was like a little hard to tell whether to what extent it was intentional, I think. Anyway, so yeah, we should go through the three misses.
But let me just say the one actionable item that Mrs. What's-It leaves them with on this brief first visit, which is that she says, yes, I'll be on my way after they've chatted for a while. And she says, but just remember, there is such a thing as a tesseract. And when she says that, the mother, Mrs. Murray, kind of jumps because tesseract was the precise scientific concept that she and her husband were exploring and that eventually caused him to disappear. Okay, so let's get to the other two witches. Who comes next?
Mrs. Who is played by Mindy Kaling. And so each of them kind of gets precisely one personality trait. Mrs. Who is probably the most obvious, where her trait is that she can only speak in famous quotations. So she offers a line from Rumi. A lot of them are kind of new agey at first, and then progressively she says something like get out, get going, or whatever the outcast line is, and she's just like outcast. And then there's a line from Hamilton later, which I was oddly moved by.
Yeah, there's also a Chris Tucker line of all things, which is very random, and I think only Ava DuVernay would think to put that. Well, I'm assuming she thought to put that in. Who knows who put that in? Well,
and it was super short, right? It was something.
It was dang. It was basically
was
a rush.
Funny.
I was going to say Rush Hour, but it was more likely a, what do you call it, Friday quote. But yes.
Yeah, and that actually is another gesture of representation on DuVernay's part,
right?
Because in the book as well, Mrs. Who can only speak in quotations, although it's presented more as a limitation in the book, sort of like, I can't express myself in human language, so I'm just borrowing bits of language from here and there. She also says them in the original language in the book and then translates them. And of course, it being a book from 1962, almost all from sort of canonical sources like Dante, Shakespeare, Pascal, etc.
Right, so they're all white men, basically.
Right. And so there are a couple women in there, I think. But yeah, Ava DuVernay is trying to mix it up by throwing in more modern and diverse voices. I mean, we can get to to me, toward the end, those quotes started, they became so cloying that I couldn't stand it anymore. They just, as you say, all seem to be expressing the same kind of, most of them, with the exception of maybe Dang, seem to be expressing the same sort of vacuous self-help affirmations.
Yeah. I mean, there are just this movie has what, precisely one theme, which is just like, love yourself.
It's self-help. It's a self-help book.
Yeah.
Or a movie self-help movie. Yes.
And like, self-love is like a superpower, which is, you know, a nice theme, but they just like, hit it so hard, saying it over and over again. Like, at least the Mindy Kaling character finds ways to express it through these quotes, whereas most of the time they're just saying it outright over and over again.
I will say, I did also like Reese Witherspoon's sort of very spunky take on Mrs. What's-It, and the fact that, yes, you had Oprah being the
Oprah.
She was being Oprah. She's Oprah like times 100,000. But we also had Mrs. What's-It, who was she was kind of grinding against that and kept telling Charles Wallace, like, I'm underwhelmed. I'm disappointed. Why isn't she everything you say that she is? And in this way, I feel it reminded me of those sort of adults who won't give you straight out, say, like, you're great. They'll just kind of prod you in that direction to make you see that by undercutting you. And I liked that.
Yeah, Mrs. What's-It is my favorite of the misses. She makes the most sense and seems the most like a real character. She's nothing like the character from the book, and she doesn't have any particular history or development. None of them do, which is a real flaw, but at least she is something besides a quote, affirmation machine.
And she has a crush on Zach Galifianakis's character.
Oh, yeah, we've got to get to that very, very strange scene. Let's just get to Mrs. Witch, who is, of course, Oprah Winfrey. She's the last of the three to appear. And it's sort of implied that because she's the most powerful, because she's the most kind of immaterial, that it's harder for her to materialize than the others. In fact, in the book, she's just a shimmer. You never see Mrs. Witch. But of course, that would be kind of unfilmable. So what about the first appearance of Oprah as Mrs. Witch?
I don't know. Annihilation filmed a shimmer somehow. So.
I have to say, Dana, when you said that, I just heard the Annihilation noise in my head. I was like, I hope Dana's not going to ask me the next question because I'm not prepared. Yeah. Oprah. It plays. So there's.
That's the name of this spoiler.
I can never the name of which Miss she is because I just think witch. Of her as Oprah. Yeah, Mrs. Witch. It is deliberately confusing, I suppose. And it this is a role that kind of plays on Oprah's, as you said in your review, Aisha, like life coach personality. It you know, given how self-helpy this movie is, it makes sense that Oprah is in there. And I do think that the movie maybe tries to play with the comedy of having Oprah in this role a little bit. There's this moment where, so Oprah, Mrs. Witch, can change sizes very dramatically. And there's this moment where she is like as large as the Statue of Liberty. And they just like brush her cheek in awe for a second. Yeah. And like, who among us would not like to brush Oprah's cheek in awe?
Yeah, that made me think, what if she does run for president? That could be used in one of her campaign ads. Like a huge shot of her face with bedazzled eyebrows. Because we didn't mention that when every time you see her, she's got sort of like Swarovski crystals glued across her brows. There was and this tiny little hand coming up to touch her. And then underneath that, it could say Oprah 2020.
Her outfits, I mean, all of the outfits are of the three witches, I think, are pretty amazing. Like the costumes in this movie in general, I think, are wonderful.
Yeah.
There's a great.
Well,
great...
I think they're too over the top. But anyway, I mean, in some scenes, they're great, but sometimes they just seem like a jumble of color for the sake of crazy color. And I didn't know what they were saying about the character.
Yeah. Right. We can get to that. I suspect I think I maybe know what scene you're talking about. There's a quote. This is from the same Melina Ryzik New York Times piece that I quoted from earlier. But Oprah described her look in this movie as, quote, Beyonce's aunt from another planet, which is a pretty wonderful description.
I'm just picturing Mama Tina creating those costumes for her Wrinkle in Time.
So once the three ladies have all gotten together and issued their various axiomatic bromides from Rumi to the kids, it's time to go into outer space. And remind me of what the very first space wrinkle they make is.
They go to Uriel, the planet.
Oh, right.
Which is the like very kind of Sound of Music, The Hills Are Alive one, where they basically just like run around through green fields and flowers.
I have to say that I was least impressed by those visual effects. It looked way too CGI green screeny.
It's sort of odd. It's a $100 million movie, and a lot of the green screen was very obvious green screen.
I had flashbacks to The Great and Powerful Oz, that movie with James Franco from a few years ago, which also was just overly CGI really bad, and you can see like the outline of their bodies, you know, they're not actually there. I was not a fan. I wanted to bask in the glorious beautiful colors because it's very lush and vivid, but it just falls flat.
Yeah, one critic described that land as sort of looking like where the Teletubbies live, and that is sort of how it feels.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And yet the children, again, this seems just not psychologically motivated. Like, they've just had this terrifying wrinkling through time and space and ended up on another planet with these three witches, and the witches say, oh, go ahead, enjoy the hills or whatever, and suddenly they're prancing around, running, like having fun. The whole thing didn't make any psychological sense. But we've got to get to the transformation of Mrs. Brexit. Okay, so here is something. I'm going to show you guys the cover to the book right now. I brought in my childhood copy of Wrinkle in Time. So that is basically what Mrs. What's-It transforms into in the book, which is this sort of like bald
Pegasus
marble centaur creature.
Or centaur, yeah.
Yeah, who's described as being this very kind of serene, smooth, mysterious creature that speaks in this voice that sounds like trumpets. And the three kids climb onto this marble centaur and it flies them to the place that they need to go. Now, I'm not saying that the movie needs to stick with what the book does. It's totally fine that Ava DuVernay reimagines it.
Don't you insult the flying kale, Dana.
But what she transforms
into. Step away from the flying kale.
All right, you take the flying kale. What does Reese transform into?
I believe I just said a flying kale. She's just this flying lettuce leaf. And it's so wonderful.
The chin of Reese Witherspoon.
Just, right. Her face looks vaguely like Reese Witherspoon, although not so much that, like, before when I saw the trailer, I just became obsessed with this character who in my head was just flying lettuce guy and couldn't wait to find out. And so I apologize to flying lettuce woman for misgendering her. And it's just like, have you ever seen anything like that before? No. Whereas I've seen a million flying centaurs. Come on, Dana.
I feel like I have seen it. I don't remember what it was, but it It just looked like, it kind of reminded me of the heart of Tafiti, or Tafiti from Moana, the giant green woman.
I feel like in Moana, it makes complete sense why she's a plant woman, right? It's all about the regeneration of life, but yes. I'm not quite sure why they need to climb on an endive to fly to their next location.
And then they don't even wind up making it. They run into the, what was that thing? Kamazots? Like the giant black hole, essentially, cuts them off. So they have this adventure for maybe a minute, and then they're having fun, and then it abruptly ends, and she's not a lettuce anymore.
Dana, you're saying it doesn't make sense. A, that's exactly why it's so wonderful, and B, like, how does a flying centaur make any more sense? Like, a horse, if you have the bottom half of a horse, like, if she grew wings, like the bottom half of an eagle or something, that might make sense, but why does she grow the bottom half of a horse and become a man in order to fly?
Okay, well, I'm not saying again that it has to be as it is in the book, but the transformation of genders, for example, is a really cool moment in the book. I mean, just the idea that she's not anything. Even when she was Mrs. What's-It, she was just taking a human form, that all three of them, in fact, it comes out later in the book that she used to be a star and she was a dying star who gave her life to fight the It, and there was this whole backstory. But at least it's kind of, I'm not saying at all that it has to be a marble centaur, but that sense to me of kind of majesty and strangeness in the transformation seemed a little bit lost in the lettuce moment. Anyway, so the lettuce leaf, as you say, that whole adventure turns into a crash where Calvin falls to the ground. But the magic flowers save him from being crushed. And then they still have to get to their next location, which I think their next location is, as you say, the planet Kamazots. I love that name.
Well, no, it's the happy medium.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Before they go to Kamazots, which is the place where the evil is emanating from, they have to be taken down deep into this crystal cave, which I think is on a different planet, Orion, right?
I think so, yes.
And to meet this person, the happy medium, who in the book is a woman kind of with a crystal ball, like very typical witch. It's actually great that they gender switched her and made her into Zach Galifianakis, but
with a man bun.
And Zach Galifianakis as the happy medium is a great piece of casting. But I found that scene incredibly, A, dramatically uncompelling, and B, I'm not even sure what it was supposed to be getting across. So they all descend into this crystal cave where Zach Galifianakis in a man bun and a robe greets them. And what knowledge does he impart?
Well,
he's a seer,
most,
I think, right?
Yeah. Well, so there's a pun in his name, right? Where he is both, as you say, a medium, as if with a crystal ball, like somebody who communes, with, you know, spirits from great distances, like a medium does. But also, he's kind of obsessed with balance and compromise.
So he insists everyone stand in tree pose, for example, to keep their balance on these kind of wobbly crystal rocks.
Right. I mean, part of the reason that to me, the whole crystal rock thing was pretty underwhelming. Like, this is just one of the less exciting and less imaginative landscapes to me. But I really liked him in this just because he seemed to bring a sort of self-consciousness, a very, like, straight-faced self-consciousness about the ridiculousness of everything that was happening that really worked for me, and is the kind of thing that I think they just, like, they didn't quite nail that balance when, like, Reese Witherspoon shows up out of nowhere and is the fish out of water. Anyway, they start to try to do some sort of activity, but then the real reason that this scene happens is so that Mrs. Witch can, like, do a big info dump about what the It is. And I can't remember what else she explains about the universe. Maybe it's just what the It is.
Yeah, I think that's... Oh, yeah, it's what the It is and how all the evil is taking over. I think this is also when the montage happens.
Right.
Where Mrs. Witch is describing how the evil is slowly taking over the universe and making and corrupting humans, basically. And so we see all these characters we've already seen. We see the Principal Jenkins, who is played by Andre Holland. We see him in a scene where we actually find out that he's becoming the principal. This is like a flashback, I guess. And then all the other teachers are jealous for some reason.
Because of the It.
Because of the It. And then the bully from Meg's class, we see her. She's like struggling with
body,
I don't know why I'm laughing,
issues.
But like she very dramatically, she's like has this, there's a thing on her wall that says like, don't eat, you're fat. Bulimia, blah, blah, blah.
I think you're laughing because it's not super subtle.
It's not subtle at all. It reminded me, I've made this comparison to something else before, but it just reminded me of the video for Unpretty from TLC, where it's just like everything is so dramatic and body image. And then we also see Calvin's. So Calvin has daddy issues. They're not like they're not daddy issues of the proportion of the movie It. but they are, I guess his dad is just wants him to be better and he can't handle that.
Right. So they all have issues of self-doubt, and the It we learn is basically like self-doubt. And you're supposed to, whenever the It, which is this like nebulous dark form, is around, you're supposed to look away from it and look at the light. So it's kind of always look at the
it's the anti-Oprah. It's the anti-Oprah. So they learn about this dark force that's slowly taking over the universe, and that is the thing that has abducted Alex Murray, or is somehow keeping him hostage. Now, I think this is a moment when we get to what I consider, I'm glad we can spoil here, because this to me was the biggest wah in the whole movie, is that the Mrs. What's It, Who, and Which specifically say, oh, we can't possibly tesser, which is the verb for using the tesseract to travel through space-time, right? We can't possibly tesser to Kamazots. It's impossible. And then they immediately do it. It's the very next place they go.
Well, they get there, but they like can't move, and then they slowly vanish or something.
That's like the one time that Mrs. Who is not speaking in quotes, just because she tessered and now it's messed up with her body or something.
Oh, right. I guess what they meant by that is we, the three witches, can't go there because for some reason our essences will dissolve, which is what happens when they go there. But they make it sound like, oh, it's impossible. It's against the laws of physics. We can't get to that evil planet that's enveloped by the It. And then seconds later, they're there. And so to me, the fact that at least none of the characters asked about that, I don't know. There was a real hole in the logic there. And in general, the world building in this movie leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah. There's a lot of sources of confusion for me here. So I think the next thing that happens is this tornado comes, at which point I just completely lost track of Charles Wallace. Like, where did Charles Wallace go during the tornado?
Yeah, he literally disappears for this giant. They're in a forest on Kamazots just after the misses have left. And so then all of a sudden this tornado starts whipping up the forest and Charles Wallace is nowhere to be found, but they're, you know, now it's just Meg and Calvin and they're running. Meg does the physics thing that we already talked about where she calculates that, oh, we have to get over that wall.
We have the exact amount of thrust in order to slingshot.
Right.
If we get into that,
the tornado.
Into that wizened stump, we'll be thrown over the cliff.
And so they do that and then they get in the stump. The tornado whisks them away. They land in it. And then somehow Charles Wallace just pops up and is like, hey, guys.
Yeah.
And then it's like never explained where he was, what happened to him. He's just the precocious kid who knows everything and just pops up when needed.
Nor do they seem particularly surprised. That almost seemed as if a scene had been left on the cutting room floor or something, because there was a real hole there. It's as if she's trying to hurry them to the center of the action. But to me, it really took me out of the world when that happened. It was specifically when the missus said, we can't possibly do this, and then they all did it and no one asked why. Then I just thought, well, I guess we're just not supposed to ask questions. We just passively watch for the rest of the movie. And I think I lost.
Look away from the darkness, Dana. Look towards the light.
Well, the missus was, they were also still guiding them somehow. Their voices were still there, at least up until after the tornado, and then they disappeared. Because they told them, you have to get over that wall, which is why they were running towards the wall. And it was very ethereal, like, the wall, you have to go to the wall. And then they wound up there, and then we don't hear from them again until nearly the end of the movie. So I guess that brings them, is this where they get, they're at Kamazots, so then go to the suburbs, right?
Yeah, the next thing is this very like Stepford Wives-y sequence where they're in these this suburb where all the houses look exactly the same and all of the kids like dribble the ball at the same.
Kids.
Yeah, I thought this sequence was pretty successful. It was very, like I said, Stepford Wives, where it reminded me of like the early Tim Burton movies where he does all these versions
Edward
of Burbank, like Edward Scissorhands. Yeah. Where it's this extreme conformity.
So the children all bounce a ball exactly in time. But the thing is, and this is a really key scene from the book that I feel like every kid who read this book remembers, this freaky scene of the children moving in exact unison and then the mothers coming out and calling them in. But it served a thematic purpose in the book, and I don't see that it does in the movie. I mean, part of that just has to do with it was written in the mid-20th century. You know, the idea of a critique of conformity and kind of suburban uniformity made a lot more sense then. But I don't think that excuse completely stands, because it's still in the movie. It still stands for something that's menacing. I agree the scene has a menacing mood to it that's well established, but it doesn't seem to further any story or theme at all. Whereas in the book, it becomes this whole sort of thing about this planet that's been routinized and mechanized because everyone's controlled by the It. And there's a little bit of a geography of that world set up and a psychography, I guess, of that world. And here it just seemed like a freaky scene that was in there to establish a freaky mood.
Yeah. All of this is making me feel like maybe this should have been a mini series or something. And maybe then it would be more adaptable because this whole portion of the movie, while it's full of amazing imagery, moves so quickly from one thing to the next that I wasn't really sure what we're supposed to get out of
right. Each
thing. And we should probably move to the next thing, which is they run from, you know, one of the Stepford wives who wants to give them sandwiches or something to this beach where, again, I thought is this the thing you didn't like the colors at?
You mean the beach scene where everybody is wearing day glow colors and it looks kind of like a commercial? Yeah, I didn't know what that, again, was establishing, except for this is a freaky planet with some freaky clothes on it.
Right. To me, that was the point
of the color.
Like Tim
Burton's Alice in Wonderland or something. Right.
What I got from the color was that it was just like uncannily coordinated. And so there was still the sense that even though people did not look quite as conformist and quite as the same as each other as in the previous scene in the suburbs, like still there was the sense that something was wrong because like all of these people could not have possibly come up with the same color palette for that day.
So one of the people that emerges from this sea of color coordinated bathers is Michael Pena as the man with red eyes. He's got these crazy clown colors like the rest of them. And he has, I'm not sure when you first see them, he has them, but eventually you see that he has these freaky demonic red eyes. And he seems to be trying to usher them into the world of the It and to try to get them to.
Well, at first he's just trying to get them to eat sandwiches.
But it was clearly like, well, sorry to back up a bit, but this is the same thing. But I saw both of these scenes, the beach scene and the suburban scene, as it was the It's attempt to lure them into, you know, into the It.
Right.
In the same way, again, I'm going to make the comparison again, in the same way that It in the movie, the clown, he like attempts to lure kids with like different scenes and different moments and these like weird visualizations. And so I saw the sandwich bit as it was clear he was just trying to bring them in, and he picks out Charles Wallace specifically because he knows that Charles Wallace, somehow as precocious as he is and as smart as he is, he falls for the bait, which is that his sandwich tastes weird. And then I don't know why it being made of sand, the sandwich being made of sand, suddenly leads him to saying one, like 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 2 equals 4. And that's how they like, and that's how they bond. And it was really weird.
I mean, I feel like such a pedant saying this over and over again, but in the book, there is an actual reason that Charles Wallace is the most vulnerable to the It, and it has to do with his pride and arrogance, basically. So it's a flaw, which we don't get to see Charles Wallace have any of in the movie. And there's a setup, I think it's the misses that tell them at some point, you each have your thing that you have to watch out for, and Charles Wallace has to watch out for his pride, right? Because he's this brilliant kid, and he kind of thinks that he's special. And that ends up being what kind of seduces him to get zombified and incorporated into the It brain. Now, all that is completely unclear in the movie. So I agree with you, Aisha. You have no idea why he would be the one that would be taken in. In fact, you'd think that he would be the one who would resist the best.
So it's basically like, don't take candy from strangers. And Meg knows that. Poor dumb Levi Miller. What is the character's name again?
Calvin.
He just starts eating that sandwich.
He's chowing down. He's enjoying it.
But he listens to Meg, right? Whereas Charles Wallace doesn't listen, which I guess is his pride. He's just like, no, you're wrong. The sandwich is delicious. It doesn't take like sand to me.
No, he tastes that it's sand.
Calvin's still eating it because it doesn't taste like sand to him. Because
I mixed it up.
Yeah,
huh.
Yeah. Calvin's still eating because it doesn't taste like sand. But it does taste like sand to Charles Wallace because I guess the It knows
this doesn't make sense.
No,
we can't sort this.
It tastes like sand to
sense.
Charles Wallace because Charles Wallace knows what's real because his mind is beyond their minds. But then, would he be taken in? Right.
Then,
that's why you need the pride and arrogance detail. You need, which i.e. you need some character development and for people to have some flaws and vulnerabilities for their characters to be believable. But so long and short of it is that the Charles Wallace is taken in by the it and becomes the demon child that for the first time makes him an interesting character. And then somehow they leave the Michael Peña situation and they go inside what David Edelstein in his review described as a giant golf ball. So yeah, they go into this featureless space with sort of like dimpled walls.
To me, it was like they were inside the Epcot Center or something, which exactly. I guess is kind of the same image. Yeah, and then the movie becomes what Aisha in a review compared to that episode of The Twilight Zone. I forget the name of it, but where the kid has superpowers and everyone is just like his slave because of it, his whole family, which would be interesting if that wasn't already a famous episode that hadn't already been spoofed by The Simpsons and so on. So this bit didn't really work for me either, the demon child, Charles Wallace.
Well, how they get out of the spherical ball doesn't really make any sense at all. And it again has to do with this sudden positing of Meg's incredible abilities to calculate physics experiments.
She can like see a hidden dimension behind the giant golf ball. And so everything sort of starts looking like a blueprint. Yeah. I mean, it looks cool. Again, like, it made for a great trailer, but it was a little unclear to me what exactly was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it sort of harks back to the self-esteem theme again, in that she kind of realizes that she can do it. Like, one of the things that she has is this math ability that allows her to sort of almost, like, create these virtual steps within the golf ball and ascend those steps to a strange pink hallway. This sounds so cool and trippy
when
we're describing
bling
it.
It's the Hotline Bling video, I feel like.
Yeah, completely.
Complete with Sade.
But instead of Drake doing dad dancing, we have actual dad.
Right.
So this was the part where I cried.
Yes.
Me too.
No, it's a great scene.
Did all three of us cry in this scene?
I don't think I cried, but I got choked up. I would say if I cried, I cry all the time in movies. And I think the movie had lost me a little too much for me to cry. But man, like Storm Reid in particular is so convincing in this scene.
She really is. And
also Ava DuVernay lets it breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes,
I mean, there's a moment where she and Chris Pine come together. He's standing there in this kind of column of light, like he's kind of imprisoned. And the moment when they see each other and approach each other, it was strange because, I was kind of emotionally dead by that point. And yet I came alive and cried during that scene. Maybe I just want to hug Chris Pine.
That too. Although I also wanted to hug her because that was the moment where I thought to myself, she's a really strong actress or actor. Like it was her face, seeing him, it really felt as though she was seeing him for the first time in 4 years. And when you couple that with the new Sade song that is playing over it, it's just kind of perfect.
Oh, so the Sade, so I wasn't sure how I felt about the Sade. Like, I love Sade, like no disrespect to Sade, but whenever pop songs would appear in this movie, I found them very intrusive.
I felt like that with the other songs, which felt...
It was like a Sia one.
It was Sia. Okay, that made sense. It's always either Sia or, what's her name, Ellie Goulding. Like, in those young adult movies, they always have that. Ugh. But I thought the Sade worked. It felt warm. It felt like it matched what was happening on the screen with the colors that were happening. And
It worked better than the other ones, for sure.
Yeah, it didn't feel jarring to me. It felt like it worked.
What feels jarring about the Sade song to me, we'll get there in a second, is when Charles Wallace quotes it. It's just so embarrassing.
Did he quote it?
Wait, is that the song that they're singing at the end?
Well, there's this line. I think it's the chorus of the song, this thing about flower of the universe, sweet child of mine. Sweet child of mine. That's another song, but dear child of mine or something like
Welcome
that.
Welcome to the jungle.
Wait, that was the song? That was the Sade song? I don't remember the actual lyrics from it.
Well, a pop song that plays. I'm not sure if it's when she and Chris Pine are hugging or not, but I think it is. And it sounded like Sade singing to me. There's this thing about flower of the universe, whatever. Like, fine, in a song it works.
Oh, I do remember
But
that.
There's this moment, it's quite a bit later, I think, where Meg is waking up from one of her various, you know, like swoons after being slapped around by the it. And Charles Wallace has come back to himself. And he quotes the song. And it's just, A, like, how would he know the song that was playing on the soundtrack in a scene that he wasn't even in? And B, it's just so cringy that an 8-year-old kid would say flower of the universe, sweet child of mine to his sister.
I totally didn't catch that. I was wondering what those lyrics were because I didn't remember them singing a song together.
Yeah.
So I just thought to myself, well, this is odd, but okay. Maybe I missed the part where they were singing to each other earlier.
It's just kind of the culmination of the cloying relationship that they're shown as having, which would be so much more believable if it were more understated, right? I mean, that's just not what you say when your sister is waking up from near death. It's just weird. Okay, but we haven't gotten there yet because he's still evil. So he's evil and there's kind of like electric bolts of evil shooting down his face.
He kind of looks like Harry Potter with the lightning bolt is what I couldn't help but keep thinking of.
Yeah, and Ava sometimes shoots him from an upward angle so that if she was crouching
and
makes him lean. Well, he's huge, but he also looks like scary because whenever you shoot anyone from that angle where it's like directly, very harshly, you see their chin jutting out. It's just in his eyes. It was weird. His eyes turned red and it was scary.
So he turns against his own dad. They end up falling back into the golf ball, I think because of Charles Wallace's machinations. I'm not sure. But Chris Pine and Storm Reid, dad and daughter, plonk back down into the middle of the spherical featureless space where Calvin and the kids still are, right? And then
somehow they end up inside I don't know. The mechanics were not super
clear to me. Well,
but
before they do, it's important to know that Calvin and the dad peel off. Right? Calvin and the dad kind of test her back to Earth without them or something.
I don't know where they went. I didn't really.
Yeah, they test her back because Alex, the dad, wanted to leave what's his name behind?
Charles Wallace
behind.
Oh, right.
And Meg says, no, we can't leave him behind. And which is also that whole thing was just weird to me. I would have left him behind, but okay.
Well, that goes to a very important question about the dad's motivation that's never quite settled in the movie, right? Like how much willfulness, how much intentionality is there behind Chris Pine's leaving his family, right, in the first place? And then also him wanting to leave Charles Wallace at that moment. I kind of agree. I'd cut my losses. Like I've been in outer space for 4 years. Both my kids miraculously appeared. One of them is still normal. The other one has become an evil demon.
Right.
I have a chance of getting back to home with one of them. I mean, I'm going to cut my losses and go.
He specifically says, I'm not going to lose both my children. But Meg says, no, I have to stay. And so she tests hers and they, I guess, go back or whatever. And so then that leads to that giant showdown between evil Charles Wallace and Meg in this forest on dark
branches.
I think
it's basically a brain, right? It's like a giant black brain is the
sense. Yeah, it sort of feels like you're inside, way
firing.
Inside a brain with these kind of black neurons connecting. I mean, in the book, it's a literal brain. It is like this like pulsing, gross brain like on a dais in the middle of a room, and it's really disgusting the way it's described. I was sort of looking forward to the pulsating brain.
Oh, but I totally forgot it. I remember that.
It's a really unforgettably eerie kind of image. And again, it doesn't have to be a pink brain on a dais exactly like in the book, but the unlocatability of the it was another disappointment to me. Yeah. It was sort of like when they get there, it's just a dark, branchy space. It doesn't have any, there's no place that you can kind of locate the evil or address it. I guess it's being spoken through the kid, Charles Wallace. But yeah, it's just kind of a mean space that they're in where once in a while one of the black neuron things reaches out and kind of slaps you around. But so how does she solve everything? What is the tesser? Remember, I think this is the thing that Chris Pine says right before he disappears, like the tesser is love.
It's love. I wonder how many times the word love appears in this movie. Like, it's gotta
like
be
vibranium?
Like dozens.
Is it the vibranium of A Wrinkle in Time?
It's not even a surprise that the Tesseract is love or whatever, that the solution to everything is love, because that's exactly what Chris Pine says in the scene where he disappears way, way earlier in the movie,
right? Well, it's also what's implied by Mrs. Witch's earlier stuff about evil being self-doubt and blah, 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 and the fact that she wants to help Meg learn how to love herself. Like, it all makes sense.
The way she breaks the spell on Charles Wallace is basically affirming that she loves him, even as he is trying to kill her with the branches of the swooping it thing. And also, this was kind of a cool moment to affirm that he loves her, right? I mean, there's a moment where she says, and I know you love me too, because I deserve love. And, you know, so she's taken the Oprah mantle and decided to affirm for herself. And I have to say that as much as that had been way overly cloyingly set up by all the zillions of affirmations of how amazing Meg is by everyone, that to me, what did seem sort of like the turning point, right? The real turning point is where she says, I love you and you also love me. So Charles comes back to himself. And then they seem to have no problem getting away, right? Once he gets back to himself, they just hop into the tesser zone.
I guess. And the it is gone, I guess.
I couldn't remember this either. And I just like assumed that they think positively and the power of love and self-love defeats the Tesser, but I couldn't actually remember how this happens.
I mean, the idea is supposed to be that she gets better at this Tessering process throughout the book, you know, both because she gets more self-confidence and because, you know, she just sort of like gets practice at doing it, you know. So that last experience of going through the Tesser is kind of beautiful, right? They show her sort of smiling and sort of somersaulting through these ribbony textures and things like that. And I think the idea is sort of supposed to be like, oh, now I can do it with ease and joy. And it's not just like a painful transition anymore. But again, because the previous times were so compressed and so kind of ill-explained by the movie, you don't really necessarily understand that sense.
And then also the misses, don't they give her something? They each give her something before she tessers.
No, right. So that's earlier. And we forgot this. This is how she's able to like see the other dimension inside the giant golf ball, is that she has those glasses that she got from, I think it's Mrs. Who. She's given three gifts. The glasses to see behind, like to see the unseen. She's given like the gift of knowing her faults, which is another, okay, this is another question. Like, how does the gift of knowing her faults help her succeed?
Right, because I thought that's all she knows, right? which is why she's like so.
It seems like it's the opposite helps her win. Just she's like, I embrace my faults, and maybe that's what it is.
Well, I think that was what it was supposed to be, but it's weird.
Yeah, well, I guess the only scene in which you could say she's somehow embracing her faults, although calling these faults is kind of buying into the its logic, is when you see the, as you said, like the cute version of her with the ironed hair and the whatever trendy clothes, which she rejects. I mean, as another critic said, it's just in a way the climax of this movie just shows you that it's saying that the entire universe's fate hinges on one tween girl's self-esteem, you know, basically like when she realizes like, wait, I can have natural hair and wear jeans and sneakers, then everything is right again with the universe.
Right. Well, so which gets me to a question. I'm curious for you guys. Do you guys think you would have liked? I feel so not the target audience for this movie. Like, I've rarely felt less the target audience for a movie in a way that's kind of interesting. But do you guys think that you would have liked this movie when you were the right age for this movie, which I would guess is like 8 to 14 or something? And Dana, do you think your daughter will like this movie? Who was in that age range?
I was trying to think about that when I was watching it. She just read the book, and she also read the next book in the series, A Wind in the Door. I don't know if she'll make it through the whole. It's a quintet of books. She will be interested in seeing it. I think she might like some things about it, but I mean, maybe I'm just being braggy on my kid, but I feel like it's going to be a little too unsubtle even for her. You know, right. I feel like the self-help message is so not kid-like, you know, that it's so from a world that she doesn't know or care about, which is a sort of new age affirmation-y world, that I feel like the last 20 minutes would grate on her the way that they grate on me, possibly. But it might be that just the spectacle of it and the fun of riding on a lettuce leaf with Reese Witherspoon and things like that would make up for it. I'm not sure. I think that this movie will be a mild hit with kids. Like, it's a decent family movie. It's disappointing as Ava DuVernay's big Disney project, but as a kind of, you know, tween ode to affirmation and self-love, it's not terrible.
Yeah, you can do a lot worse with this genre.
If it had been directed by Joe Blow, Disney director, white dude, right? I mean, I think we would probably be calling it a pretty unusual, if not totally successful, experiment.
Yeah. Right. I think probably around the age of, if I was 12 or younger, I would have liked it. Around 13, I think I started just getting very cynical about the world. So probably not then. But I have two sisters who are 8 and almost 10, and I think that they will really like this movie. But then again, they also really like that movie Sing, which I heard is not good. So
I kind of like Sing. Oh, I'm curious to hear what your little sisters think of it. And I will show it to my daughter and see.
Yeah, yeah.
We should talk a little bit about representation and diversity and stuff in this movie, since it's one of the big things that it tries to do and in some cases does do well. What did you guys think of how that was handled in the movie? I mean, I kind of appreciated that it was not very foregrounded, right? I mean, the multiculturalism of the family is just a kind of a given.
Yeah, I think that, you know, save for the hair comments, which I think you can interpret in many ways. It doesn't just have to be, you know, plenty of white Jewish girls I knew hated their curly hair. So that's neither here nor there. But I do think that it was nice to just see that naturally, not just with the family, but then also just in the background, like I always notice those things. How many people can I spot who don't look white in the background of any given movie? And everywhere it felt just naturally. And
it's even Kamazots.
Right. Even Kamazots were the suburban kids. There were lots of different, you know, not just black, but also some who looked Asian, Latino. So it was nice to see that. And I think that I have faith that this movie, despite it being underwhelming, I think, as an adult, I have faith that we've gotten to a point now where the failure of this does not hinge on the representation of people of color going forward. I think that Ava will be fine. She will move on to the next project and excel there. And I would love to see her work with, you know, youth again and work within the perspective of young girls of color. I think that's a really underseen still genre or underseen mode that we see these film and TV shows in. And yeah, I mean, it was $100 million, so it's not, it doesn't have that high of a bar.
And Disney has made that like 12 times over. Well, 10 times over with Black Panther. It's about to cross $1 billion.
Right, right. So I think it's a good thing for representation. And I do think that there will be a lot of kids who will see it and really like it. And that might be the most important part. Like if kids don't like it, then maybe not. But right. If they do, I think it'll be, I would call it successful in that sense.
It's too scary for what, kids under 8 or something? Like, I found the end legitimately disturbing.
Yeah, I guess the idea of your little brother being taken over by a zombie mentality is scary. Yeah, yeah, there's
so
some scary
stuff.
It's
kind of like a narrow age range in the target audience.
But if you could make it through a superhero movie, you could make it through this. It's got nothing scarier than your average Marvel movie.
I don't think it's much scarier than something like, I barely remember Bridge to Terabithia, but I don't know, the Narnia movies.
It's actually co-written by the author of Bridge to Terabithia, Jeff Stockwell.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't think it's that much scarier than that, or even the Harry Potter books. And there are tons of kids, like young kids who saw that.
I mean, I think I just also want to stipulate that some people, even some adult critics, really loved this movie. I think there are some people that are just going to vibrate on its frequency somehow. And you know, maybe there are people who are more sincere than us and like less. I don't know. I didn't want this movie to be
the
snarky, though.
Is love.
I love the sincerity of the movie, but it was just more the overkill of that smothering. You know, if somebody tried to build up my self-esteem the way that the three misses try to build up Meg's, I would automatically distrust them because it would seem insincere.
Yeah. To me, I think what I would identify as the two main problems of the movie are A, what you just suggested, the kind of complete just like redundancy of the dialogue, and the fact that it's not even just that it's like unsubtle, but that people don't talk like real humans. Because they're constantly saying the same thing that you just heard from the other character, like stating the plot, like the principal says, you really don't trust easily, do you? Which is just like, that's not something a principal would say to one of his students.
A therapist, maybe.
Stating the theme of the movie.
I also just, on the principal for one second, I also just love that the principal wants her to get over the fact that her dad has disappeared into time-space.
What kind of principal would act like that?
Well, all the adults, again, like the adults who are talking about them in Charles Wallace overhears, first of all, why would you, what teacher would do that? You never know what kid is going to be around listening to that. And I don't know. It did make it seem in a way that maybe the adults, not that they were evil per se, but that they just don't understand. And that's nothing new.
Yeah. So I think that's the one of two main problems. And then I think the second one is just it being kind of confusing, like the sense that maybe there are scenes missing, just like not understanding always how one scene transitions to the next and why characters are doing what they're doing. Like, what is up with the sandwiches and who eats the sandwiches and why?
One plus one equals two. Why does he say that?
Everybody knows that if you say your addition tables, you immediately become absorbed by an evil entity. All right. Well, you guys, we haven't made any progress in understanding what happened, but it was really fun discussing it with you. I also just want to send you both to the book. It really is cool and lots of fun.
I hated it in middle school.
Were you not a sci-fi fantasy person?
Yeah, I still am not to some extent.
I'm not either, nor was I then. And it wasn't, I will say, it wasn't a book I treasured and wanted to read constantly and reread like many books as a kid. It wasn't my Anne of Green Gables or something, but it was pretty great. And the second book, A Wind in the Door, is really, really fantastic. It would be great if somebody made a movie of that, but I sort of hope that Ava goes on to something different. All right, thank you two for coming in to spoil with me.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Dana.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, you can rate it and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for future movies or TV shows you'd like us to spoil or any other feedback to share, you can send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. For Aisha Harris and Forrest Wickman, I'm Dana Stevens. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.